body. Yata, like. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Without my husband, I cannot live for a moment. If you want to eat my husband, it would be better to eat me first. For without my husband, I'm as good as a dead body. Definitely need to put this one in context. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In the Vedic culture, there is a system known as sati or sahamarana, in which a woman dies with her husband. According to this system, if the husband dies, the wife will voluntarily die by falling in the blazing funeral pyre of her husband. Here in this verse, the feelings inherent in this culture are expressed by the wife of the Brahmin. A woman without a husband is like a dead body. Therefore, according to Vedic culture, a girl must be married. This is the responsibility of her father. A girl may be given in charity, and a husband may have more than one wife, but a girl must be married. This is Vedic culture. A woman is supposed to be always dependent. In her childhood, she is dependent on her father, in youth, on her husband, and in old age, on her elderly sons. According to Manusmita, she is never independent. Independence for a woman means miserable life. In this age, so many girls are unmarried and falsely imagining themselves free, but their life is miserable. Here's an instance in which a woman felt that without her husband, she was nothing but a dead body. Om Gyanatim Randasya Gyananjana Salakya Chakshurmitani Nantasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpatyu Vishcha Kribasindhi Bevicha Patitano Pavane Vyo Vaishvedya Mo Namaha. So in this part of the Bhagavatam, the wife of the Brahmin is trying to give so many arguments to the Rakshasa not to eat her husband. And at first, of course, she appeals to him on more higher spiritual grounds. And now she is finally appealing more on a personal level. In other words, what will happen to me? Have some compassion on my situation if you were to kill my husband. So here we're getting some description in this verse and in Srila Prabhupada's purport of the ideal position of a chaste wife in Vedic culture. And so we're hearing how the chaste wife is always dependent upon her husband and does not have a position of independence, even to the point of undergoing this sati rite, where the woman would give up her own life in the funeral pyre along with her husband. Now, of course, this is a very much part of a different age and a different culture. And so I'd like to discuss a little bit about how we might have some understanding about the relative roles of men and women, particularly within Krishna consciousness. In previous verses, there's been some discussion already in the Bhagavatam of the powers of a chaste woman who the wife of the Brahmin exemplifies. And we can understand that even though she was not successful, as we'll see in the next verse tomorrow, in her arguments to the Rakshasa, he disregarded all of these good arguments due to his nature, still she had this great power to be able to curse him. So this certainly, along with the chastity of a faithful wife, comes great power. So that's there. But I'd like to discuss a little further, since that point has already been described at some length in the previous few days, how we might look at these roles of men and women, particularly in light of Vedic culture and Vedic knowledge, which sometimes seems very, very different from our current stage and our current state in Kali Yuga 2010 America. Obviously quite a contrast in the culture that we're living in. First of all, I think that we can understand that there are certainly qualitative differences between men and women. Obviously there are differences in physiology, and certainly there are also differences in psychology. So the nature or the temperament of men and women definitely has differences. I think we can acknowledge that, and at the same time understand that ultimately the spiritual position is equal. In our course in the Grihasa Vision Team, one of our chapters or one of our lessons is on the roles of gender roles, or the roles of men and women in Krishna consciousness. And I think our subtitle, that slogan, is material difference, spiritual equality. So that's something that we always have to keep in mind, that while there are differences on the material platform or differences in different bodies, just like we can see even within men or within women, there are many, many differences. people have very different qualities. Even devotees have very different qualities. Some devotees are very academic, very intelligent. They're able to memorize scripture. Other of us are not. And so, you know, we try to serve in whatever capacity that we can do. But at the same time, there is no ultimate difference in the quality of that service if the quality of devotion is equal. So even though we see that there are differences, certainly, in sometimes in the capacities or the propensities or the temperament between the different genders, we can see that neither is necessarily superior. They're simply different, and the idea is to use those abilities, use those propensities in Krishna service. Of course, one of our best examples is in the story of Krishna book in the 23rd chapter of the wives of the Brahmins. The wives of the Brahmins, of course, when they heard, well, first of all, of course, their husbands, when they heard that Krishna and Balaram wanted to be fed, they refused to go. Who are these Vaishyas? Who are these coward boys? We're not interested. We are very, very busy engaging in our sacrificial performances. When the wives of the Brahmins went, when they heard that Krishna and Balaram were hungry, they immediately gave up everything, even disobeying their husbands, and they took the food immediately to Krishna Balaram and fed them. And it became very clear that their devotion was so much stronger than that of their husbands. In the 23rd chapter, Srila Prabhupada says, women in general, being very simple at heart, can very easily take to Krishna consciousness. And when they develop love of Krishna, they can easily get liberation from the clutches of Maya, which are very difficult for even so-called intelligent and learned men to surpass. So Srila Prabhupada is pointing out sort of the simple faith that is often the nature of women. And Prabhupada points out in that chapter that all throughout the world, we see in different cultures, it is usually the women who are attending churches, and the women who tend to be more religious and more spiritually inclined. So in other words, that simple faith can be superior to intellectual ability or to the ritualistic ceremonial abilities that the Brahmins possessed in this case. In fact, it's interesting that when the Brahmins went back to their husbands, at first they were fearful that their husbands would be angry at them. They didn't want to go back. Krishna says, no, you have to go back. He gave them that instruction. And the husbands at that point had come to their senses, and not only were they not angry, but they greatly praised their wives, and they condemned themselves that due to their false pride had been curbed because they could not realize the Supreme Personality of Godhead right in front of them. So what was the point of all their Vedic knowledge, all of their rituals, all of their brahminical abilities, if they did not understand the purpose, which was to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So not only were they very much appreciative of their wives, but in that chapter, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura points out that from that time on, the Brahmins actually accepted their wives as their gurus, as their spiritual master. So we can see from an example like that, that because of the great devotion of the wives of Brahmins, they surpassed their so-called more intellectual or more learned husbands. So once again, we get to this point of Krishna consciousness or devotional service or bhakti being the most important quality. Here in this particular purport, this topic of dependency is raised. It's stated that the woman should always be dependent. To be dependent upon the father as a child, on the husband when she's older, and then in old age, dependent upon the elderly sons. Now, actually, this is a very nice system for social arrangement, because in the Vedic society, everyone was taken care of. Nobody was without. We didn't have in a Vedic society, you didn't have abandoned women, abandoned children, single women, this kind of thing. Everybody had a place and a position, and everyone was taken care of and protected. So along with this concept of dependency, the other side of that is the concept of protection. So you can't have dependency without protection and proper protection. So we know that in this age of Kali, everything has become degraded. So we don't have the same systems of protection in place. Just like we could say the ideal Vedic society, the Rajarshi, the saintly king, is the one who should be in control. The Vedic culture rejected democracy and other forms of government and said there should be the saintly king. who is guided by the Brahmins, who is in charge. No democracy. Now, of course, in Kali Yuga, we can see that often does not work. And in fact, monarchy has been largely abolished and thrown out because of the excesses of the monarchy, because of the excesses of rulers, that they do not follow religious principles, they're not saintly kings, they are not acting according to the Vedic culture and protecting the citizens properly. And in fact, more often than not, leaders, whether they are monarchs or elected presidents, their main goal is to exploit the people to gain as much position, power, money, prestige, etc. as possible, without regard to the needs of the people. So I think we can see in that analogy, just as we have an ideal of Vedic culture of how things should be, or we have an ideal of the role of the Brahmin, how the role of the Brahmin should be respected in Vedic culture. And it's a very, very elevated position. But yet we see in Kali Yuga that Brahmins are very degraded. In fact, it's described by Prabhupada in the age of Kali, there practically are no Brahmins, no real Brahmins. The type of Brahmins who could ignite the sacred fire by mantra, who could revive the life of the animal sacrificed to the fire, who would come back. So we don't have these kind of abilities. We don't have these powers. So we don't have qualified Brahmins. We don't have qualified kings and rulers. And often we don't have the qualification of men and husbands, unfortunately, that would lead to this situation of complete faith, devotion, and dependency on the behalf of very qualified and chaste wives. So everything is more or less broken down, and so we have to look at all of this sort of within the context and the situation that we are facing. So because of this age of Kali, that we don't have pure Vedic culture, what we have, actually even within Krishna consciousness, if you think about it, how are our cultural norms and values formed? You know, we have a sort of a combination of the current culture that we live in and how we've been brought up and how we've been raised and what our belief systems are, which usually are pretty materialistic. Then we have sort of an overlay of what we hear from the Srimad Bhagavatam of ideal Vedic culture of 5,000 years ago. And then sometimes we have the influence of what we are calling Vedic culture, which really isn't, which is really modern India. In other words, what is done in India, which really may or may not have some correlation with Vedic culture. Maybe there's some remnants, but often it's very much broken down. You know, and then we have Srila Prabhupada's teachings, which was kind of a very interesting amalgamation or a very, very nice blending of all of these things, where Srila Prabhupada incorporated the needs of Western society in this age with the ideals and practices of Vedic culture. So ultimately, our real sort of where do we go with this? Where do we get our inspiration, our direction on how these things should be done? Ultimately, from Srila Prabhupada. Because this is the position of the guru, the Jagat Guru is able to take ultimate principles, to take the absolute principles from the Vedas and apply them properly to time and circumstance. So we always need to look at Srila Prabhupada's words, his purports, his conversations, and his examples that he gave about how to sort of negotiate these sometimes difficult topics. Because I think topics like this are often controversial, and there's different opinions and different applications, and you'll hear, you know, many different sides of these situations. So really, our shelter is always Srila Prabhupada and his instructions. So the one thing I do want, I'm going to read some of his instructions in these areas and some of the things that he said. And one thing I think I just also want to say from my own perspective is one thing that we've learned, and I've experienced this for many, many years of counseling couples and things like this, that we have to be careful of stereotyping, that we sometimes read something in the Bhagavatam and we form a stereotypical idea of this is how it should be, you know, in an ideal world, but often these stereotypes are not really helpful. They're really not that helpful for us to understand the reality of how we practice Krishna consciousness. So I think we have to be a little bit careful in that regard. So Srila Prabhupada generally emphasized our spiritual nature. We all heard, you're not your body, from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita onward. So our emphasis in Krishna consciousness is always on the nature of the soul, not on the nature of the body. We have these bodies, They have roles to play. They have propensities. There's different ways that we engage the bodies in devotional service, you know, but really it's for the purpose of awakening the soul, which is neither male nor female. Although, if anything, if you had to say which was the soul, you'd have to say it's female, because we're all Prakriti, and Prakriti is the female principle, and of course Krishna is Purusha. So in that sense, we are all the enjoyed, we're all subservient to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So actually, to claim oneself as to be male or female is really a illusion, the bodily conception of life. And beyond that, Srila Prabhupada really emphasized the engagement in Krishna consciousness. How we could all be engaged in Krishna consciousness and transcend the bodily designations. This is from Srila Prabhupada's purport of chapter 31 of Canto 3. Now, this is a very interesting chapter. I just gave a class on it in Gainesville the other day, which talks about the living entity in the womb. It talks about all the miseries of being born in the womb and how one is an illusion. And then towards the end of the chapter starts talking about how the living entity becomes illusion once he's born and starts to grow up, and how the greatest illusion that he falls into is the illusion created by sexual desire. So Prabhupada says, to be either a woman or a man only involves bodily dress. The soul in nature is actually the marginal energy of the Supreme Lord. The relationship between man and woman is very complicated. But the substance is that one who aspires to ascend to the transcendental stage of spiritual realization should be very careful in accepting the association of a woman. In the stage of Krishna consciousness, however, such restriction of association may be slackened, because if a man and a woman's attachment is not to each other, but to Krishna, then both of them are equally eligible to get out of the material entanglement and reach the abode of Krishna. As is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, anyone who seriously takes to Krishna consciousness, whether in the lowest species of life, or a woman, or of less intelligent classes, such as mercantile and labor classes, will go back home, back to Godhead, and reach the abode of Krishna. A man should not be attached to a woman, nor should a woman be attached to a man. Both man and woman should be attached to the service of the Lord. Then there's the possibility of liberation from material entanglement for both of them. 3:31-41. So this danger of material attachment applies equally to men and women. Men are attached to women, women become attached to men, and if that attachment to the opposite sex is greater than one's attachment to Krishna, then one remains bound in this material world. But of course, on the other hand, if man and woman are together serving Krishna, then that attachment gradually decreases and the attachment to Krishna increases. In the next verse of that chapter, it says, a woman, therefore, this is interesting because there are two or three verses in a row that's describing the downside of attachment to women, how you should not become attached to women, how this degrades one, and one's spiritual life is practically ruined if one's attached to women. Then the Bhagavatam takes the other side, which is interesting. You don't hear this as often. A woman, therefore, should consider her husband, her house, and her children to be an arrangement of the external energy of the Lord for her death, just as the sweet singing of the hunter is death for the deer. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In these instructions of Lord Kapiladeva, it is explained that not only is woman the gateway to hell for man, but man is also the gateway to hell for woman. It is a question of attachment. A man becomes attached to a woman because of her service, her beauty, and her many other assets. And similarly, a woman becomes attached to a man for his giving her a nice place to live, ornaments, dress, and children. It is a question of attachment for one another. As long as either is attached to the other for such material enjoyment, the woman is dangerous for the man, and the man is also dangerous for the woman. But if the attachment is transferred to Krishna, both of them become Krishna conscious, then marriage is very nice. Engage the children, engage the wife, and engage the husband, all in Krishna conscious duties, and then all of these bodily or material attachments will disappear. So, Srila Prabhupada explains so clearly and so nicely what is the real position. Yes, the wife should be serving the husband, and yes, the husband should be serving the wife. They may serve in different ways, but service is the key. And ultimately, both the service of the husband and of the wife should be directed to the service of Krishna and Guru. when the service is aligned in that way, then as Prabhupada is saying, it becomes perfect. And there is no difficulty. There's no problem. You know, so once again, it is material attachment and attachment to the opposite sex that is the difficulty, not anything particularly inherent within the man or within the woman. Once Prabhupada said, he said, men are good, women are good, but together they're bad, or something like that. You know, in other words, it's the material attachment or the sexual attraction which is the binding force of this material world. And of course, that's overcome through the process of devotional service. And actually, in a purport to the Prabhupada, quotes Rupa Goswami's Yukta Vairagya verse from Bhaktivedanta Sindhu about how everything needs to be utilized in Krishna consciousness. And through that utilization, then everything becomes purified and one's activity becomes not binding but becomes liberating. So, the other important point that Srila Prabhupada makes over and over again, that through the activity of Krishna consciousness, and particularly through the activity of preaching, that all of these bodily conceptions are dissipated. And there becomes, and rather than being a problem, it becomes actually part of the solution to this material life. So I was looking through the Veda base and the folio, and there are many, many examples where Srila Prabhupada had talked about, you know, Krishna consciousness in the early days, in the 60s and 70s, he referred to us usually as boys and girls. Once he even said, actually, nobody in our movement is over 26 years old, or something like that. Of course, except for himself. You know, Srila Prabhupada was, for so many years, the only adult around us. And so he would often talk about his boys and girls, and he talked about how they are all preaching together. And Prabhupada would say this in so many times and circumstances, actually very proudly. Srila Prabhupada was very proud that somehow these American hippie boys and girls were all preaching Krishna consciousness. And he would, in many, many room conversations, he would give examples of that. You know, and I would, I remember Rukmini, probably most of you know Rukmini, she was an early devotee from New York. I think she joined about 1967. She said once they were they were in a room and they were talking, and Srila Prabhupada was saying, all of you should go out and start temples now. And Rukmini was 16 years old at the time, and she said, even the girls? The Prabhupada said, yes, of course. Why not? Everyone. Everyone preach Krishna consciousness. So anyway, this was the mood that Srila Prabhupada had, the mood of just wonderfully engaging everyone in Krishna service. He wasn't concerned with whether they were men or women or boys or girls, whether they were a 16-year-old girl or whether they were a learned Brahmin. You know, he engaged all of us in Krishna consciousness, and not only engaged us in Krishna consciousness, but engaged us in preaching and spreading Krishna consciousness throughout the world. And Prabhupada even said that this was one of his secrets of success. He explained that by engaging so many men, women, householders, etc., in Krishna consciousness, he was successful. I was reading one lecture, a room conversation, Srila Prabhupada said, he said, my Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, made so many brahmacharis and sannyasis for preaching throughout the world. He said, I am making so many grihasthas who are preaching throughout the world. So this was, this was the Guru's expertise in knowing time, place, and circumstance. You know, knowing this is what he was dealing with. And in fact, I want to read one more purport. This is a very nice purport in Adi Leela 7, 31, 32. Where Srila Prabhupada explains this point. He says, an acharya who comes for the service of the Lord cannot be expected to conform to a stereotype, for he must find the ways and means by which Krishna consciousness may be spread. Sometimes jealous persons criticize the Krishna consciousness movement because it engages equally both boys and girls in distributing love of Godhead. Not knowing that boys and girls in countries like Europe and America mix very freely, these fools and rascals criticize the boys and girls in Krishna consciousness for intermingling. But these rascals should consider that one cannot suddenly change a community's social customs. However, since both the boys and girls are being trained to become preachers, these girls are not ordinary girls, but they are as good as their brothers who are preaching Krishna consciousness. Therefore, to engage both boys and girls in fully transcendental activities is a policy intended to spread the Krishna consciousness movement. Their stereotype methods will never help spread Krishna consciousness. Therefore, what we are doing is perfect by the grace of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, for it is he who has proposed to invent a way to capture those who have strayed from Krishna consciousness. So we can see that the mood of Srila Prabhupada is very clear and very consistent to simply engage everyone in Krishna's service. And that appreciation was there, for all of his disciples and actually for all living entities throughout the world, because that's the mercy and the compassion of the spiritual master. The spiritual master does not make distinction. The spiritual master engages everyone properly according to their propensities, and primarily for the purpose of spreading Krishna consciousness throughout the world. So because we all have different tendencies, we have different bodies, we have different psychologies, then people need to be engaged accordingly. And everyone, tends to gravitate towards those propensities. So often you see that there are different services, more typically, that women may do or men may do. But again, we have to be careful not to stereotype those services and exclude anybody from any aspect of devotional service. Our purpose is to use everything and everyone to spread Krishna consciousness, to engage everyone as they can be engaged, and that really is a more important principle than any, as Prabhupada said, a stereotype conception. Again, we need to keep all of these stories that are from hundreds of thousands of years ago, in different yugas, in different times and places, sort of in perspective, and take the lessons from them. We can learn the ideal. We can learn that this is ideal society, but also be conscious about where we are in time and place and understand the higher principle of engaging everyone in Krishna consciousness and devotional service. So I'll stop at that point. Further comments, questions, realizations? Don Mahanprabhu?
Choose from that culture, mm-hmm. more so, she was an extremely chaste lady, and I got some introspection from talking with her over those years, how she had a very simple mindset. She never had to interact with so many different agitating type of thoughts on how to do things, and it made her life very peaceful, and that way, because Prabhupada would say, simple living, high thinking. So, of course, they didn't have so much of the high thinking. But I definitely did notice a peacefulness and simplicity that she had from that.
That is a good point. I mean, in other words, all these things in Vedic culture are not there just because there's some, they're not a material cultural consideration. But they are there for a purpose. And as you said, if people actually live this way, then their minds become peaceful, they increase in their spiritual life and Krishna consciousness, and the whole society comes together very peacefully. So while we may want to attempt to, and Srila Prabhupada instructed us to try to establish a Varnashram Dharma and a Vedic culture and Vedic society, it is interesting to see how there was certainly more of those qualities in former generations, even outside of India. That's very true. I thought this would be a controversial topic. Yes. Srila Dita.
Well, thank you for dealing with this controversial topic. I was just wondering, though, because in our own community, we see that right now you've been talking about this attraction between man and woman, and but we have to not be attached like that. But is there also a sense, because when we think of the Veda culture, too, there's a sense of duty, that maybe the attraction's not even there. Sometimes we see a young girl who's given to an old Brahmin in appreciation for some kindness, and yet she accepts it. It's not that she's attracted. So I think sometimes we're experiencing that when the attraction is gone, there may be divorce or, you know, splitting up the family and stuff like that. So is there also, does Prabhupada also address, or our scriptures also address, a sense of duty rather than just attraction between man and woman and, you know, a husband-wife relationship?
Well, that's a great point, and I really appreciate you bringing that out, because, you know, there's so many different aspects of it that this is kind of another one of those aspects of the sides of it that, you know, part of that, the whole idea of the husband-wife acting in Krishna consciousness is really based upon one's duty. So we have both material dharma and we have sanatana dharma. You know, we have our eternal relationship with Krishna, but we also do have those duties and dharmas within this material world while we are here, and it's definitely our obligation to act and work within according to religious principles. And that's another thing that we see as part of Kali Yuga, that these religious principles break down more and more. You know, so we see it, you know, so we see now that we have, last figure I saw was about a 46% divorce rate, that people often do not stay together, and amongst devotees it's not much better. And you know, this is something that we need to address, we need to think about and work about, that, you know, it's not always that everything is going to be materially wonderful. And that, you know, that, you know, sometimes we think, well, somehow Krishna's going to make all these perfect material arrangements for me to, you know, enjoy in this life, you know, as well as becoming Krishna conscious along the way somewhere. And it's not like that. It's really Krishna's making all arrangements for us to become Krishna conscious. Because we've said, Lord, I want to surrender to you. I want to become your devotee. We've surrendered to our spiritual master, saying, please help us to go back home, back to Godhead, to learn to love Krishna. So Krishna makes arrangements for us to do this, to surrender and to love him, and that doesn't always mean that it's going to be, you know, materially just what we had in mind. It should be the perfect situation. And that's, as you were saying, where duty is very, very strong. You know, I think for the devotee, it's a combination of both duty and faith. It's, you know, duty to, you know, follow the orders of the spiritual master, follow religious principles, to, you know, act accordingly, and also faith that whatever situation Krishna has put us in is ultimately, you know, for our best, and that Krishna knows best. And if we try to artificially make so many other arrangements, you know, for enjoyment, they probably are not going to work. Follow that up?
Well, the other aspect to this attraction versus duty seems to be attraction has to do with our own senses, and we're in the center. And of course, this is our dilemma, why we got put in the material world anyway, is because we wanted to be the center, the controller, the enjoyer. Whereas duty, because I'm mostly thinking of children, when children are involved, like in a marriage, but yet there's not... we're feeling that, oh, but I'm not attracted anymore to my partner and I can't stay with him. But yet if duty was foremost or seen as important, then all of a sudden we're not putting ourselves in the center, we're putting our children in the center, the good of the family, then, you know, ultimately the good of the society and like that. So I was just concerned about that aspect. Seeing duty as also being part of our spiritual journey, that we're removing ourselves from the center and doing what's good for, you know, it's that service mood like you were bringing up, serving the family, serving the society, and the ultimate goal of serving Krishna, you know, learning that, how to become selfless and render unconditional service. It's not based on the condition that I'm attracted to my partner or that I'm getting some enjoyment, but it's based on my service to the family and the good of the family, and ultimately, you know, the good of the society, the greater good.
Thank you. Very, very nice point. Ultimately, for a devotee, that is what our relationships revolve around more and more. when Krishna's the center and our service to Krishna, you know, is sort of like the link or the guiding principle in a relationship, then household life is very nice. You know, then it's, and even if it's not so nice, it's tolerable, as you said, because, you know, there is that sense of duty and that and sense of service. And preferably, of course, in best case scenario, there's that joint sense of service together. And therefore, you know, with that as being the center, then the other material attractions and all those things are really less important. Because I think you pointed out earlier, that lasts a very brief moment in eternity, right? You know, there's like that brief moment of where people fall in love and they're very attracted, and that is such an illusory, temporary, you know, time or quality that there really needs to, relationships need to be built on a real foundation, and that real foundation is around devotional service. You know, when Krishna and the Guru and the service is the center, then, you know, just like, and we experience this in many relationships. I mean, I can think of even like other devotees just that I've worked with and served with in temples. Sometimes you develop a very, very close relationship with that person, and I realize that somebody that, you know, now I'm not serving with, when I think back about it, I don't really have much in common with them. And, you know, it's not like necessarily a person I would have picked out as a friend, but because we did service together very closely, you know, there was a very close relationship. So even more so with husband and wife, you know, when the service is there, then, you know, and we talk about love. I mean, that's actually the basis of real love. You know, where Krishna's in the center, then there really is a loving relationship. Anything else? All glories to Srila Prabhupada.